this very, very simple practice of resting our attention in the senses, in the here and now, reveals so much. This whole practice is about taking a closer look at the life that you're living, not the life that you imagine that you're living, but what's really here. And there's a very deep intimacy that can be available in this practice. You may have come to realize how depleted you are in this meditation as you watched yourself with the head bobbing meditation. Or you might have noticed how agitated you are, or how restless, or perhaps how happy you are in this moment. It's one thing to read a book on meditation, and it's an entirely different thing to experience, to come into kind of the raw contact of what's here. And also to look into the nature of awareness itself. It can be very liberating. Very, very simple practice. Usually what we find is that we are constantly predisposed, our mind. We kind of have our mind set in some way. And when we get to experience something exactly as it is, without any preferences or without any embellishment, new possibilities begin to arise where they didn't exist before. One way to describe this process is it's like driving a car with a window that's really clean. You see everything very, very clearly. Remember, when I was back in college, I co-managed a 1,000-acre farm. And the one traffic accident I had was when I took one of our trucks into town. It was all spattered with mud, and I pulled out of the bank and right into the sunlight, and instantly I couldn't see a single thing, and ran into a car. But our awareness like that sometimes can be so obscured, we can't actually see what is in front of us because of all the obscurations. This practice speaks at length about the nature of those obscurations, of the mind states that make it impossible to be present. When we're utterly bound up in all the different flavors of aversion, when the mind is caught in judgment or blame or anger or ill will or hatred, or when the mind is just restless and in constant fantasy and constantly looking for something better somewhere, or when we're caught in worry and anxiety, we can't break out of that. Or we're lost in that density, you know, either sleepy or numb, or kind of those times when we're cycling into a depressive kind of hopeless state. And when we're locked into self-doubt, these five major mental states are all part of what make it impossible to see what's actually there. Oftentimes when we start to practice, we begin to realize how smudged the windshield really is. We see just how hard it is to come into this practice where the basic guidance is to relax, be in the body, notice what happens. And we notice how we're constantly reacting, how the mind is just really gonzo. But over time, we get to see more deeply. We get to free up our attention, and we get to see things in the simplicity that they really are. And it's this quality of simplicity which really is the key to freedom. The Zen master Shunryo Suzuki, when he would praise one of his students, he would call them simple. And when he was really annoyed with a student, he'd call them clever. And in this part of the globe, we have trained ourselves to be clever. It's very much about being clever and about being right. As someone said, the world is divided into those who think they're right. That's the end of that sentence. What that simplicity does is it gives us a sense of interconnectedness. When we are not trying to manufacture an experience other than what is happening right here, right now, there can be, at times, a sense of relaxing into what's here. And then subsequently, a shift in our consciousness from someone who's on their way somewhere to someone who's actually here, who can actually acknowledge and feel the richness and the vastness of what's going on. Someone once complained to their meditation teacher that they were bored. And the teacher said, boredom is simply the failure to pay attention. And it surprises me sometimes how when my mind is really active, and my mind gets really active, that when I can somehow, by some kind of grace, bring it back into what's really happening, just how much is actually going on in any given moment. The whole symphony of sounds that are happening, just on the edge of your awareness, those which are closest. All the sensations in the body, the movement of the mind and emotion. All of this becomes to us to be more available when we can slow down and train ourselves to relax and train ourselves to pay attention. So this practice can begin to be a skill that can begin to permeate our life. Many people notice after a while that they're just a little bit less reactive. It's just a little bit more awareness when we're just about to move into some kind of pre-programmed response. And we begin to see more into what motivates us. We begin to see what pushes us toward that wanting and what's behind that which pulls us back. So training ourselves to be more aware is a very complex inquiry. How do we train ourselves to be more aware? My father used to say, how do you teach someone to take a hint? You know, it's just part of awareness, it's part of consciousness. One of the ways that I found helpful is to remember just how simple this practice really is. One of my teachers, someone I consider a really wonderful teacher, went to Burma. This is maybe about 25 years ago. He went to study, and he had given himself 8 months to do intensive study. And he had all these visions of, you know, sitting at the feet of a master and pondering all these deep questions. He got to this little ashram. They gave him a little cassette tape with a little cassette player. And they said, there's your kuti, you know, there's your hut. Let's check in 8 months and see how you're doing. He spent 8 months with this little 25-minute meditation, which is the basic meditation that we were practicing, being aware of the senses, which is the practice which the Buddha taught. We can very, very easily complicate this process. So it's one thing to just listen to a tape for 8 months, and there are other approaches which are a little more systematic. Another way that we can begin to train ourselves is this very, very fundamental practice of awareness of the body, awareness of the senses, recognizing that whenever you are awake to the senses, you are truly here and now. When you're in your mind, most of the time you're either planning in the future or you're reviewing in the past. And with that basis, we begin to see a little more into the nature of the moment-to-moment-to-moment experience and how every sensation, every single sensation, will morph into one of three possibilities. And based on that, we move into all kinds of reactive patterns. Any sensation will come into a quality of pleasantness, a quality of unpleasantness, or a quality of neither, or just more of a neutral feeling. So when we really get to slow down, we can begin to notice that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. And we can also notice how we're holding it in our experience. As I was driving down here tonight, the traffic was a little tight, and I was kind of thinking about this talk, and I was just sort of watching my experience. A big gas tanker was filling up a gas station, so it had blocked two lanes, and all the cars were backed up. And I saw that, and I watched my body tighten. You know, and then from that tightened feeling was starting hallucinating of how late I was going to be. Or coming up to a light and realizing that as it turned yellow, I had just enough room to gun it and get through the intersection, and like sort of that exhilaration of I made it, you know, that little victory. Or my phone ringing and just watching how, you know, my wife was calling, and first there was a tightening around concern. You know, well, why would she be calling me? We just talked a little while ago. What happened? What went wrong? Because I was paying attention, I could see how in any given moment I was having a visceral reaction to what's going on. It can be a very interesting thing to watch when you're moving through the day, how in any given moment the phone rings, you're going to have a reaction. Someone walks on the elevator, there's either going to be a feeling of self-protection, or if it's someone you know and you haven't seen in a long time, more of like an expansive opening feeling. So paying attention on this level to the level of what's called Vedana, or this felt sense, can be very, very revealing. First to notice how it arises, the interpretation of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then the really critical thing is how you're holding it. Are you holding it? How are you reacting to it? Is it from wanting to nuke it? Is it from wanting to hang on to it? Or are you just kind of bored because it's not really not really having an impact? Another element is to notice how this unpleasant, pleasant, neutral feeling plus an interpretation from the mind will manifest as some kind of emotion or mood. And so then we get to see the whole play of emotion. And oftentimes for many of us in a culture where we sort of have to numb ourselves to all the overstimulation, there can sometimes be a sense of not feeling enough. We don't really let things impact us too much. And one of the byproducts of a mindfulness practice is we become more sensitive. The good news is we become more sensitive to the 10,000 joys of this life. The other side of it is we become more sensitive to the 10,000 sorrows of this life. All that becomes a part of this practice. One of the things that we can begin to do to shift our experience a little bit is this practice of saying yes to whatever arises. Most of the time we're kind of in a inner self-protective stance. When we feel safe, we can actually say yes. So this experience of irritation, what if I was to say yes to this and actually investigate it? What would that be like? Yesterday I was walking barefoot and I stepped on some glass. And, you know, most glass now is like safety glass. You know, it kind of breaks into little pieces. This was not safety glass. It actually had split into these tiny, tiny, tiny little shards. And they kind of got ground into my foot. And so I was you know, picking, there were probably about maybe 50 of these little shards. So I'm picking them, you know, picking them away, and my wife said, "Well, would you like some help?" And my usual response is, "No, I can handle it." But I thought, well, why not? And then I realized that kind of like out of control feeling of someone with a needle picking at the sole of your foot, you know? And I watched this whole, like, just this clenching. And for some reason, I noticed it. And I just decided to get curious about it. You know, how curious could I be to these sensations? And I was really surprised. I actually managed to not react, but actually to kind of observe the sensations just for what they were. They really weren't that bad. The hallucination I had in the beginning was how horrible the experience was going to be. I think in that same way, when we experience physical pain, part of this practice of mindfulness is to be aware of what's called the second arrow. How we imagine how horrible it is. And we imagine how terrible it's going to be. And as Mark Twain said, the worst things in my life never actually happened. When we can remove that second arrow and come into the direct experience, it may be painful, but we don't necessarily have to suffer. In that same way, when we experience strong emotion, emotion that we might label as inappropriate or too much or deeply unpleasant, when we can explore what it's like to say yes to it, it gives us access to something we didn't have access to before. So I'm trying to hold myself on a short choke chain tonight because I'd love to have some time for any questions. So I wanted to mention just two things, two ways that we can work with challenging emotions when they arise. One of them is kind of comes out of the Theravadin tradition. And what sort of makes Vipassana a unique practice is that it's not so much about moment-to-moment awareness of sensation as it is actually using awareness to investigate the phenomena of what arises. So the acronym, which I know many of you are familiar with, is RAIN, R-A-I-N. In any given moment, the fundamental practice, the two wings of a mindfulness meditation, the R is to recognize or realize what's going on. What's my experience right now? Without any embellishment, without making it any different than how it is, what's really happening? Very powerful practice. It cuts through the story. Oh, I'm feeling sorrow. This is grief. I feel grief. Whatever it might be. This is the wing of wisdom, to be able to name what's so. The A is for accepting or allowing, saying yes to it. This is the wing of compassion. When we can say yes to our experience, rather than trying to push it away, we completely change the matrix of our relationship to it. We actually have access to it. We have the possibility of becoming bigger than the issue itself. The possibility of it. The I is for investigation, or being really intimate with that experience. To really bring ourselves as deeply and intimately as we can into the very heart of what's happening. Absolutely counterintuitive to the linear rational mind. Because the linear rational mind is all designed around avoiding pain and finding more pleasure. But with mindfulness, when we can pause and move directly into the source, the cause of that experience, something can shift. As we continue to recognize and allow, we begin to realize that any given emotion has an interconnected set of other emotions. It's never, ever just one. A sense of sorrow can be connected to a sense of sadness, which can be connected to a feeling of disappointment, which might have a tendril leading over to a sense of anger. All of this is part of the matrix of our life experience. And the more we look, the more we see. And the more we can allow, and the more we can release. When we do that, when we can do that, it kind of leads to the end part of this equation, which is a sense of non-identification. In the beginning, we take these emotions very, very personally. But with awareness, when we can recognize, allow, investigate, recognize, allow, investigate, our identification begins to shift. We hold it in more of a sense of more natural awareness. This can be a tremendous practice which has helped me countless times, from times of feeling utterly stuck to finding a way that I can shift my relationship to what's going on. It was Einstein that said that no problem was ever solved in the same consciousness that created it. And this can be a way that we can shift our consciousness in a way that something that seemed problematic actually has the possibility of becoming a gift. It can open us up to a lesson that we hadn't fully been able to grasp before. Another way of exploring emotion, particularly strong, difficult emotion, doesn't come so much from the Theravadan tradition, but it comes more from the Tibetan tradition. And this is the practice of Tonglen, which again seems very, very counterintuitive. And there are a few levels to how you can practice Tonglen. The most kind of direct and immediate way to touch into that whatever strong emotion you may be feeling is to say to yourself, other people feel this too. Other people feel this too. And as you inhale, you breathe in that feeling. You're actually moving into intimacy and where you feel it in your heart. And as you breathe out, you give it space. You just kind of like, you give it light, you relax. It's enormously powerful. My mother yesterday fell, she's 86, she fell and broke her hip. And had a partial hip replacement last night, is in tremendous pain. She has really moving toward Alzheimer's and is just deeply, deeply confused and a lot of pain today. And so I've just been just trying to be with that experience. And as I, when I can sort of identify the feeling of concern for her, and when I breathe in and just remind myself other people feel this too, it just reminds me how about everyone either has lost or will lose their mother. Everyone without exception. When I can do that, it opens my consciousness, it opens my heart, and it makes it more bearable. It becomes more of a shared experience. So part of this practice of Tonglen is to breathe it in, to feel its connection with others. And there's another level of practice of Tonglen, which again may sound counterintuitive. And that is to actually sort of say to yourself, may I feel this so that others don't have to feel it. So it's almost as if you are breathing in the suffering of the world. And again, it sounds counterintuitive, but it can become a very, very powerful way of opening your consciousness, opening your heart, that actually allows that emotion, allows that pain to become more and more bearable. So I wanted to mention those as two ways to work with challenging emotion when you feel it. Some people, oftentimes when we talk about working with physical pain, working with emotions, working with obsessive thinking, oftentimes people would say, "My God, where's the happiness in here? I'm feeling good. Is it okay to feel good?" Absolutely, it's okay to feel good. And to actually savor that. Part of the 10,000 joys of this life become more available when we can truly open our hearts to them. And there can be immense value in looking at how we close down from life, how we shut ourselves off from what we perceive as too much. So I think what I would like to do is to pause my mouth and to open this up. If you have any questions about anything at all related to your practice, over these last weeks we've talked about kind of the fundamentals of practice. Anything at all, anything perhaps about working with emotions as well. We actually have a mic, and we have a wonderful mic runner. So if you have anything you'd like to share or observe, please raise your hand. We'll bring a mic to you. And I always like to assure you that having been raised a Quaker, I'm very comfortable with long, awkward silence. Yes? Yeah, yeah, the end part. When we look at our experience, this embodied experience, you know, this portable flesh unit you got, and we look at the different what are called the different foundations of awareness. You have a body. This body has lots of sensations, lots of raw data. This raw data gets interpreted as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It'll kick off stories. It'll kick off memories, associations. And then those different stories and thoughts actually kind of grouped in the different sort of clumps of different states of consciousness. And there's something beyond that. And the question really becomes, when we practice meditation, what are you? Who are you? Are you the body? You know, if your arm is amputated, are you less here? Are you your thoughts? Are you your beliefs? I know that what I believe now is very different than what I believed 20 years ago. I know that the emotions that I experience are constantly changing, so there's nothing I can find that I can really nail down as to who I am in the emotional world. So then the question becomes, what are we? Who are we? What happens usually is we get identified with one of those foundations of awareness. We get very identified with our body, particularly when it's not working right. Is there anyone here who thinks maybe you haven't been as kind to your body as you might be at some point in your life? What begins to become revealed in our practice is how our identification shifts. We become identified with the body, and we become attached. That attachment either shows up as clinging, or it'll show up as aversion. We get very attached to our emotions, either very, very wanting to hang on to them, wanting to push them away. We certainly get attached to our thoughts. How many people on this planet are right there to kill someone who doesn't believe what they believe, which is really, to me, the definition of fundamentalism. If you don't believe what I believe, then you are my enemy. So there's a way to actually train our attention to something that is beyond sensation, thought, and feeling. Many traditions refer to one level of this as the witness, which is your capacity to observe your experience. You know, in yoga, it's oftentimes called witness consciousness. And that's what happens when we become mindful. You know, when you're in an argument and you realize, what am I arguing for? I don't want to be engaging in this activity. Suddenly you just, you know, the whole thing you're so attached to just kind of falls apart. Ken Wilber had a very beautiful statement where he said that our capacity for transformation is really our capacity to witness our experience. And whenever we lose it, in some ways you can say when we lose our capacity to observe what's happening, and we just become, you know, we get pulled into the anger, we get pulled into the depression. So part of the training is we can become more identified as the awareness itself, as that observer of everything that is arising. We're actually our species, I always thought, was Homo sapiens. But the actual description of us is Homo sapiens sapiens. And that is that we have the capacity to be aware that we are aware. Which is just a really trippy thing. When you think about it, a bunch of people sitting around, what do we call ourselves? You know, someone actually figured that out, which is kind of cool. So the end part of that equation is where we can move from being very tightly identified to something. And through recognizing, allowing it, making space for it, instead of wanting to make it small, making it big, moving into it, our consciousness shifts in some way. And the way I often describe it is when the moments when the concept of I and mine falls away is when it opens up. And we've all had that experience at some point. The sense of I and my falls away and there's a connectedness. The mystery suddenly becomes alive. It was a long response. Was that helpful or any clarification? Yeah, thank you.
I have one question. It's like...
Oh, we're going to bring a mic to you.
Yeah. It's like blowing up a balloon. This is all you... Okay. When you blow up the balloon, and it's sort of like all this identification, investigation, etc. And then once you've blown up this balloon, it's there, it's big. Let go. And it goes to the sky, and it's still there, but it's somewhere else.
That's a great analogy. So for you, there's a sense of you'll have something in your experience and you'll actually allow it to kind of get big, like a balloon, and you can actually have the sense of letting it go.
Because you put the effort into it, blowing it up and all that sort of thing, and then once you've done that, okay, we made this, mm-hmm. It was a shell, and now we made it, now we let it go.
That's great. One of the things I'll oftentimes do is to, if I'm experiencing something, physical pain or particularly something emotional, is I'll ask myself, well, how big could this get? What would happen if I let this fill the room? It just creates a shift, some kind of internal shift. Instead of trying to control it or make it small, when I make it big, the whole frame of reference can shift in a pretty cool way. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
This may be a little too hedonistic for a Buddhist session, but my understanding is sometimes when you meditate, you can get kind of a runner's high. Your hormones get changed in such a way that it's kind of euphoria. And I would like to feel that, so... Is there any type of meditation that would be more or less conducive to that kind of running time?
You can always meditate with recreational drugs. So there are all kinds of different techniques that can invoke different states. And, you know, there are certain breathing techniques, you know, that are very, very powerful for shifting your consciousness. There are different techniques for getting very, very concentrated. And concentration can take you into very, very deep bliss states. Now, those are possible as well. But it brings up a very interesting distinction, at least for me, so I'll talk about it. And that is the difference between invoking experiences that can be powerful and pleasurable, and the practice of non-invocation. Very, very big difference. For many, many years, I spent 23 years living in a yoga ashram and learning all kinds of techniques for getting really stoned, you know, basically, naturally. You know, all these different pranayama, different breathing techniques, third eye meditation, chanting. You can get really buzzed on these techniques. And I had a whole kit bag full of them. And then I began to realize that these techniques would sort of, I'd get high, but then I'd come down again. And then I remember something Ram Dass said quite famously after his many, many years of spiritual practice and chemical research, where he said the realization for him was that we're not here to get high, we're here to get free. And that opened me up to a whole other level of practice. And it's articulated in a number of traditions quite beautifully. I find the Dzogchen tradition, in the Tibetan tradition, speaks of it quite beautifully. And it is a practice of non-manipulation. Your practice actually becomes to not manipulate your experience in any way. And just as in any practice where you're trying to be present, you become more and more aware of all the subtle ways you're not present. When your practice becomes non-manipulation, you begin to see what a little weasel your mind is, of constantly wanting to change this, do that, fix that. And paradoxically, the practice of non-manipulation can lead to very, very profound bliss states. The state that is referred to in Buddhist practice as kind of the flower, you know, the flowering of our practice is equanimity. And that is in any given moment where there is nothing to add, there's nothing to take away. You would not wish this moment to be any different than how it is. That is considered the flower of the practice. That is the lotus that's floating on the water. So that's not to say that that using certain techniques that give you that runner's high can be really helpful and fun and valuable, because they can be very, very helpful. To learn how to shift your consciousness in a way that becomes more skillful, very, very helpful. But to kind of recognize at the same time that while it might be helpful and help you operate at more peak efficiency, it may not necessarily be liberating. Does that help? Any other follow-up or clarification?
Well, I'm actually kind of curious. You said there are techniques and pointing techniques.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy.
I'm trying to do that.
Sure, I'd be happy. I'll be happy to share some with you. I certainly find that there's so many yogic techniques, you know, techniques of getting in the body. You know, literally when the runner's high comes when you're, you know, you are being very, very deeply in the body and the endorphins begin to release. You know, that's a really, really wonderful thing. There are lots of different pranayama, different breathing techniques that can be very, very powerful. Many people find chanting to be a very evocative experience that brings you a sense of connectedness as well. But I'll be happy to share some with you. Maybe time for one more. Yes.
You spoke about equanimity and one thing that I've always struggled with in Vipassana is knowing where to draw the line of where you should act and where you should just let go and let be. And when do you let God take over, and when do you manipulate? Because we're not corpses, after all. We have the power to act. We have the power to change things. So how do you know if you should change something if you're not happy in a situation? Do you just accept it, or do you try to change it?
What a great question. Do you mind if we go for another hour? You bring up such a deep question. And to me, it's very much about one of the other byproducts of a mindfulness practice is heightened sensitivity. And out of that sensitivity becomes a heightened sense of intuition. One of the things that I so appreciate about the Buddha's teachings is that he would often say, don't believe a word of what I'm telling you. You know, he talked a lot about understanding cause and effect, where he would just say, try a technique, make a decision about something, act on it, observe realistically what happens, evaluate, is it life enhancing, is it life depleting? Oftentimes we can get stuck in, I personally get stuck in paralysis. You know, analysis oftentimes leads to paralysis. And there can be that question of, you know, well, what do I do? Do I allow this to be? Do I act? Do I move forward? Ultimately, there is something that is available, which oftentimes is called choiceless choice, where if we can really sit with it, we realize, I do have a choice. I can do this or this or this. There's a sense of free will. But when you really get down to it, you really don't have a choice because this just sort of feels like it's the way to go. So that's a little bit of a, maybe not quite a superficial answer, but just to know that the more we can relax into our experience, to keep investigating what's there, and to really ask, what is most life-enhancing? What will be life-enhancing? What will be life-depleting? And then to not be afraid to act. But when you act, to be very aware of the consequence of that action. If you find it not to be skillful, you're under no obligation to continue. And to let and then to reevaluate again. That's a really good question. Thank you. I'll continue to sleep on that. Just a few quick announcements, and we'll end with a short meditation. First of all, thank you for your kind attention and your presence. If you'd like to be on the mailing list, and you aren't, you can sign up over there. And as always, thank you for your generosity, your donation that helps this class. A portion of your donation goes to the church for providing this space, and another portion goes to the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, and another portion goes to me. So I thank you for that. On October 8th, if you're interested in the Labyrinth, there is going to be a gathering here Friday evening. I'll put this in the e-news. A wonderful part of Buddhist practice is walking meditation. And walking meditation with a labyrinth is a very, very cool experience. And there's a beautiful labyrinth here. So if you feel drawn to that, there'll be a little gathering here then. So let's close with a short reflection. In your own way, connecting with the breath and connecting with the body and the senses. And acknowledging this physical body. Just noticing in this moment the raw experience of sensation. Sound vibration. Perception of touch, smell, taste, sight. Noticing how this raw data moves into a perception of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And noticing this chain reaction of the arising of story, the arising of mood or emotion. And in your own way, just sense who you are as the observer of all of this, as the space in which everything arises, everything changes. Sensing the field of wisdom, of that which recognizes what is so. Recognizing the field of compassion, that which can hold these 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And if you wish, in these final moments, offering a prayer for your own journey, that you may be guided, that you may be safe, may be happy and free. And in your own way, offering these out to those you love, to those you interact with in your world. Imagining it radiating out to all beings, all living things. And back again to yourself, to this breath, back to the body and the here and now. And as you're ready, you can open the eyes. Namaste. Thank you for coming out tonight. May you and your emotions have a wonderful evening together. Thank you again. Have a great night.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.